I'm Andrew Blumenfeld, and this is the Money in Politics podcast. Welcome to season two. I'm speaking today with two filmmakers about the recent release of their HBO documentary, The Swamp. It has only recently been released, but it is already getting a lot of attention because it offers a behind-the-scenes look at the machinations of Congress and the money that contributes to its dysfunction. And it does so through the potentially surprising eyes of three Republican congressmen, Florida Representative Matt Gaetz, Colorado Representative Ken Buck, and Kentucky Representative Thomas Massie. My guests today, the directors, Dan DeMauro and Morgan Peckma, spent over a year following these three self-styled reformers around, and it is fascinating to hear what they have to say behind closed doors and how that compares to the votes they cast and the personas that you see on cable news. I am both sobered and animated by the film, and I'm really excited to talk to those who made it today. But first, a quick message from Call Time AI.
You're listening to Money in Politics, brought to you by Call Time AI. Campaigning is hard. Why not make fundraising easy? Using automation and artificial intelligence, CallTime AI lets you fundraise five times faster with easy-to-use tools like instant donor research, automated voicemail drop, and donor scoring, so that you are always calling the right person at the right time with the right ask. Go online to calltime.ai to schedule a demo and start your free trial today.
So I'm here now with Daniel DeMauro and Morgan Peckma, the directors of HBO's new documentary, The Swamp. Thank you both so much for being here with me.
Thank you, Andrew.
I really enjoyed getting to watch the documentary last night, and although enjoyed is an interesting term, because while I enjoyed it, I thought it was really interesting. It's also a little bit painful to see this dark underbelly of the congressional process. I'm sure that's feedback that you've received before.
What movie about Congress wouldn't be infuriating and frustrating?
Right. Most reviews of our movies usually are that you need a shower or a drink after watching them.
That's right. Well, it certainly means that you're showing us something that we haven't seen before, which I know, even as someone who kind of works in this space, I definitely learned a lot of things, and I'm excited to talk through some of those things with you. But before we get too much into the movie, let me actually start by just asking you both to introduce yourselves for folks who are listening who don't know you and don't know your work and some of the other really interesting and amazing films you've done. It'd be great to get just a quick intro from both of you.
Sure. So we're documentary filmmakers from New York. We did a film a few years ago for Netflix called Get Me Roger Stone, which kind of tracked the degradation of our modern politics by telling Roger Stone's life story and how he, you know, succeeded in his long 30-year conquest to make Trump the president. And most recently, before this film, The Swamp on HBO, we directed an episode of the Netflix series Dirty Money, which was about Jared Kushner and his background as a businessman and a real estate mogul. And by telling his story, we kind of wanted to shed light on his upbringing and how his role as a businessman might affect how he treats policymaking in the White House. And spoiler alert, he's a slumlord millionaire. That's the name of the episode.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, we, even though we are liberal filmmakers ourselves, I mean, we have had this unique experience of spending almost a decade now tracking a lot of the most prominent figures in Trump world and trying to understand the effect these folks are having on shaping America. And, you know, we come at it, though, not from a partisan standpoint, but from a good government one. And that harkens back to my background as a political journalist and also having been the head of two good government organizations. And, you know, we try to call it like we see it. And I think that people see in our movie that we are not just critical of the Republicans, but we also call out the Democrats for their collusion in so many of these unseemly processes that you alluded to in your introduction, Andrew. And so it's very important for us to not get caught in tribalism, but to really show people an unvarnished perspective of our politics, which is very difficult to get to in these highly polarized times.
So along those lines, I thought that the perspective that this film took was really interesting because you're addressing the question of reform, political reform, ethics, and kind of financial reform in our Congress. And you do so by following three self-styled reformers and all three Republican congressmen. So maybe first just help us understand how you chose to use this as your lens for exploring this question, how you chose specifically these three congressmen to follow around for over a year.
So our producer, Matt Whitworth, came to us with this idea that, you know, he had access to these members of Congress who were willing to be sort of whistleblowers on the corruption that they see in the system with the special interest money and the big donors having complete control over the process, specifically how they control the leadership of the of both parties and how they see this as a problem that, you know, they want to speak about, and perhaps they'd be willing to participate in a documentary. So we went and talked with these congressmen and were really shocked that coming from the liberal progressive viewpoint, that sitting down and talking to these very conservative members of the Republican Party in Congress, that we actually had a lot that we agreed upon about why the system was so corrupt. So from the inception of the project, the whole conceit was, let's kind of tell the story of the corruption in Congress through these Republicans, because we really don't want to preach to the choir, and we want to make a film that's coming from a nonpartisan good government perspective to hopefully appeal to viewers across the political spectrum. So that was the intent from the beginning.
And for those that haven't yet had a chance to watch it, those three congressmen are Matt Gaetz from Florida, Ken Buck from Colorado, and Thomas Massey from Kentucky. And I'm not sure most people, you know, would have necessarily taken them all to be in the same bucket. But to your point, they sort of think of themselves as whistleblowers. What were you hoping that they'd be able to shed more light on? What kind of questions were you hoping that they'd be able to answer as you followed them around?
So often our politicians just tell us the kind of fantastical narratives that they want to weave for their constituents or for the public. And it is so rare to hear politicians speak in an unvarnished way, the kind of way that they actually speak to you when you're just person to person with them. And it was so appealing to us that these guys were willing to say on camera what they would say off camera. And so we thought that these guys had at least the firsthand knowledge to speak to the corruption in Congress, expose what is so broken about the system. But at the same time, we were well aware that as Trump-loving Republicans, there was almost an inherent hypocrisy to what they were saying, because Trump has been arguably the swampiest president in American history. And it's hard to square those two things. But we took a cinema verite approach to this film. So it's not heavy-handed with narration or we're telling you what to think. We're just taking the journey with these guys. And I think that's, you know, what that was central to our approach to trying to enable this movie to be palatable to all audiences. There are many times I think that people will be watching one scene in very different ways based upon their own partisan orientation. And that's fine with us, because the whole nature of Congress, as it was intended by the founders, was to bring people with wildly disparate views together for the common good of the nation. And that's something that's very kind of that's out of favor these days. As Democrats, we think, oh, if only Democrats control every single branch of government, then we would be able to solve our problems. And Republicans think the inverse. Well, we've actually had both those scenarios in the last two decades. And of course, neither party got just this grab bag of policy goals that they had so longed for. And that's because we're both parties are paralyzed by the special interests and the lobbyist stranglehold on Washington. And so, you know, what we wanted to do was try to create a common ground for people who are so different from our own worldviews to say, you know what, if there's nothing else, we have to fix this problem of corruption in our government, because right now our government isn't even oriented to the American people's interests, whether you live in a red state or a blue state. It's oriented to the self-serving interests of people who are just trying to profiteer off the system.
And I want to get back to the question, you use the word hypocrisy. I think the film does a great job of revealing a lot of, you know, maybe I'll put it more charitably, conflicts or tensions, but I think, yes, probably more accurately, hypocrisy or just outright dissonance. But before we get to that piece, let's continue with the point you just made. I think our audience, maybe more than most, is actually pretty familiar, unfortunately, with some of the dysfunction. But let's spend a minute or two there before moving off of it, which is, what are some of these dysfunctions that you reveal in the film? And maybe I'm curious also, what were some of the ones that surprised you the most upon doing this film that you couldn't believe that this is the way things run in Congress?
Yeah, obviously, so many Americans and certainly your listeners know of the corrupting influence of money on politics. But I think sometimes that idea is so pervasive among the public that it becomes a bit of abstract outside of just the idea of, like, you need money for a campaign. I'm a big donor. Here's some money. Now listen to me when you get in office. But it's much more systematic and structural than that. And that was a big surprise to us when we went in there. And we always say, like, for as broken and corrupt you think the government is, like, once you're in Washington, D.C., embedded in Congress, you realize it's actually far worse. So one of the most revealing things that these Republican congressmen were really willing to articulate to us and help us to understand is the leadership structure within Congress and how you have to pay for your committee assignments in Congress. And, you know, the committees are very important. They're often the one crafting the bills and writing the policy. But your party only puts you on those committees if you're able to pony up enough money to funnel into the congressional committees of both parties. So you're no longer fundraising directly for your campaign. You're fundraising for the party as a whole. And you can't go back home into your living room and ask, you know, one of your constituents for $5 to help you get on the Ways and Means Committee, which writes tax policy. The only people who are going to donate hundreds of thousands of dollars, up to $500,000 just for a seat on that Ways and Means Committee, are the ones who have a vested interest in the work product of that committee. And that's the corporations, the wealthy, the big donors who want to control that policy crafting process. So that is just the top line, most corrupt aspect about how Congress internally works. And it was, like, very important to us to expose that in the film, because it seems so simple. And I think if you're in DC, you understand how this works. But it blew our minds. And hopefully, you know, people who watch this movie, it'll blow their minds. And, you know, we should all be riled up about just how corrupt that whole system is.
And Andrew, we know that neither party is a monolith. And oftentimes, both members of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, the bases, get frustrated with the moderate members of their party for blocking policy objectives. And what's so important to understand is when the members of Congress pony up these hundreds of thousands of dollars to the campaign committees, that money is in turn dispersed by leadership. And a lot of that money goes to defending these battleground seats. So, you know, you may have a real progressive Congress member in San Francisco, and unwittingly, or at least unbeknownst to that congressman's constituents, she may be raising all this money that is going to support, you know, some blue dog Democrat in Oklahoma who will in turn frustrate the agenda from an ideological or a policy perspective of that very member of Congress. And so the way that this money works is so actually counter to so many people's goals in giving money to the members themselves. And not only do you have to pay for the committee seats, but they have this internal ranking system of A, B, and C committees. And those that ranking is not predicated upon how important the jurisdiction of these committees are to the American people. It's predicated upon how attractive it is for the lobbyists to give money to these committees. So as Dan was talking about the Ways and Means Committee that writes all the tax loopholes, that creates these massive giveaways, oftentimes for the wealthy and the corporations. Well, sure, lobbyists are only too happy to fill their coffers. But if you serve on something like the Science Committee, which you think was really important in the age of pandemics and climate change, well, that's a C committee because that's really not so attractive to the lobbyists. And in fact, there's virtually nobody who serves on the Science Committee with a science background. In fact, you know, I think Thomas Massey from our movie might be the only one because he has a degree in engineering from MIT. But most of the people who are on the Science Committee are there because in their districts, they have some big lab or something. And that is their whole reason for being on that committee is to deliver pork to the lab in their district. So it's not a meritocracy. It's not a system that has any type of reason that would resonate with normal people. It's one that's just built around the corrupting influence of money.
I'll tell you, I knew about paying for committee assignments, and yet, to your point, Dan, every time I rehear it, I re-remember it, I'm retold it, it is infuriating again. I am riled up again. I also will say I didn't know about the letter grade system, the ABC committee. I mean, just to add the icing on the cake of my frustration about how sort of blatant that all is in terms of pay to play, it was really quite frustrating. I imagine many people who watch the film will be kind of mowed over by that. I want to talk specifically about one of the congressmen that you follow. It's Congressman Matt Gaetz from Florida. He seemed to me a little bit like one not being like the other. They all had a lot in common, but one thing about him that stood out to me was how significant his national profile is relative to the other two. And I think your film does such a good job right from the beginning demonstrating that that is intentional, that is coveted, that is something that he has set out to do, to make a national profile for himself. It's one of his top goals, you know, maybe if not his top goal. And my takeaway from the way that you chronicle his public persona, and he is almost stunning in his forthrightness with you about why he seeks that. It seems because he says, yeah, I don't want to play the regular game of cozying up to lobbyists in order to get the big checks, in order to pay to leadership, in order to get the committee. He doesn't want to play that game, but it's not because he doesn't want the same power and influence. It's because he just doesn't want to do it that way. And so he's used television as an alternative way to be purposefully inflammatory. I think he expressly says that he wants to be purposefully contrarian and drive conflict and make viral moments on Twitter and Facebook so that he can raise small dollar donations, you know, in my understanding, to supplant whatever money he is foregoing in cozying up to lobbyists. So that's sort of my summary of it. I'm curious, A, was that your take on his approach? And B, if it is, are we as viewers of your film, is the takeaway that those are the two options, that you've got to be someone who cozies up to lobbyists, or you've got to be someone who's willing to say something inflammatory on Fox News every night to get small dollar donors? Is there a third way to do this, or is it just so broken that those are the only two options?
His intention is definitely to break free of the lobbyist, you know, consultant complex. And, you know, tragically, how he does that is by playing what Professor Larry Lessig says in the film, which is the politics of hate. So it's the most productive tool for fundraising that both parties have. And we kind of trace it in the film back to the era, which was ushered in by Newt Gingrich becoming speaker in the 90s, where it really became the perpetual campaign. And he really realized that the most effective way to raise money to maintain their majority was to demonize the other side. So it became less about defeating your opponent on the merits of ideas, but painting them as evil and saying, you need to give me money because I'm thwarting off the evil. I'm good, you're evil. We become more polarized. And 30 years later, it's only been exacerbated by the politicalization of the cable news media and the inflammatory extremism that is rampant on social media, and that division is desired and stoked by both parties because fundamentally they still want their reelection and their power above anything else. So that is tragic that that's how Matt Gaetz is able to break free. But again, like, ideas should win. What he's doing in a very similar way is what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who we are fans of and we're supporters of, are doing for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. She is able to create her own fundraising structure and to create her own benevolent path to support grassroots progressive candidates instead of funneling that money into the DCCC, the Democrats' congressional committee. And she is refusing to pay for her committee assignments, but she's such a rising star that she puts the leadership in a tough position and they have to give her the committee assignments because she's going to go out and expose their corruption, their hypocrisy. So the difference with her is like she's winning on the basis of ideas and principles. Now, from Matt Gaetz' perspective and conservatives' perspective, they're doing that too. And unfortunately, the result is more polarization. But we have to break free of the special interests. And if Congress can once again be restored as representing the people and not the corporations and the donors, then hopefully we'll get to a better system where it's actually a battle for ideas.
Andrew, I think when we've seen these examples of other people who have succeeded on a large scale with small dollar donations, I don't think of Bernie Sanders or Barack Obama in his initial campaign or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez using the politics of hate as the principle to, or as the hook to draw people in. Now, they may have spoken to folks' ideology in a way that fires them up and is a call to action. But I think that they've put forward a message that isn't so toxic. But, you know, to be fair to Matt Gaetz, he's really giving cable news what cable news wants. You know, so cable news wants you to go on and say something inflammatory, divisive, something that can be clipped into a viral video and propel that across social media. And if you don't give them that, they don't book you again. And so he is feeding a cycle that is in place already. He's just an astute, you know, practitioner of that. And what's so fascinating about Matt Gaetz, and I think what will be frustrating for Democrats, particularly the many people who hate Matt Gaetz, is he deliberately plays this one-dimensional character on cable news because that's the character that cable news wants. But in actuality, I think as our film shows, he's a pretty complex figure who is very smart, not the buffoon that people want to reduce him to. And he has a lot of views that actually that make him palatable to the left and enable him to have friendships with people like Ro Khanna, the progressive congressman from Silicon Valley, or Katie Hill, the former congresswoman from California. You know, he acknowledges man-made climate change. He is pro-LGBT rights. He understands very vividly the corrupting influence of money. And he can articulate these positions in a generational way where he knows like the lingo of the left. And what you feel like at times are like, wow, you could really just easily be adopting the other side and be completely fluent in the language of the Democrats, if that's the way that you wanted to go. But, you know, I hope that Matt Gaetz, you know, one of the things that as the film kind of lands on this idea that he actually does give up PAC money, that no matter how you disagree with Matt, he is doing something that should be, if not symbolic, a real lesson for the other members of his party. When he made that announcement at CPAC, there was this bizarre energy in the crowd where half the people were like, what? He can't do that. Like, that's how we fund our party. And the other side of the room saying like, wow, did he just do that? Like, finally, we can be unfettered from this corrupting influence of money. And so, you know, regardless of what you think of Matt Gaetz, you know, that is the, that's the type of model that I think we want all of our elected officials to put forward in order for us to be freed from the corrupting influence of money. And so, you know, that's why he is an interesting anti-hero to follow, because he is not this one-dimensional buffoon. And it also just harkens back to, you know, what I was saying earlier, which is that, you know, Congress is built to build coalitions around areas of common agreement. We think, having spent over a year behind closed doors in Congress, that that coalition is there in Congress to eliminate, or if not to dampen, the influence of money in politics. And we know, just traveling across the country with these members, that the American people feel that way too. And what is only stopping that from occurring is the disproportionate influence of the special interests who are putting their hand on the scale. And so, you know, that's what we were trying to accomplish with this film, was to say, you know what, we actually are on the same page on this. Don't think that we are not, just because we're so polarized as a nation. And if we don't address anything else, like, let's team up on this.
You know, getting back to the issue then that, you know, you raised a bit before about conflicts, or I think, again, you use the word hypocrisy, and just sort of there is throughout this film evidence of a gap between what these individuals are professing and then what you show them to be doing. I'll mention Gaetz first because we're talking about him, but then I'll mention the other two as well, because I thought it was evident in all three of them, but to different degrees. Gaetz, for all that he professes about reform, and even going as far as you point out at the very end of the film, you show that he has given up corporate money, the first Republican to do so. So in that way, actions sort of lining up with words. But he, you know, is steadfastly against H.R. 1, the Democrats' proposal to clean up a lot of this process, this, you know, first bill out of this Congress. He, but maybe more starkly, just is a fervent devotee of Donald Trump. And you mentioned, Morgan, at the outset, how Trump can represent this very swampy creature, sort of the epitome of the swamp. And even in your film, you know, you have Gaetz, you know, being very reform oriented in his one-on-ones with you all, but then getting on the phone and fanboying Trump about, you know, his stonewalling of Congress over this, that, or the other thing. So I want to talk about the other two as well, but let me just leave that example in front of you and just wonder, you know, how do you make sense then of that situation where here's this guy calls himself a reformer, you know, says all these things to you, but then goes out and stokes, you know, tensions between the parties and cozies up to Trump, kind of irrespective of whatever support he gets from Trump on these ethics reforms or not. And it's always or not, right? Trump is not there for Matt Gaetz when Matt Gaetz wants to enact a policy change that would, quote unquote, clean up Washington. Nevertheless, he's one of Trump's biggest fans. You know, how did you make sense of that?
I think, you know, that's the journey we take with him as a character in this film, and just kind of watching his evolution over the course of the year to actually kind of incredibly come to the realization that he has to, the least he can do is lead by example and try to give up the PAC money. But of course, there's just an inherent hypocrisy to that, because Trump has been such a swampy president, and, you know, as we show in the film, that his populism of restoring the government to serve the people and not the special interests was nothing but campaign rhetoric. You know, we show clips in our film where he says, oh, I hated the term drain the swamp, and then I started using it and people went crazy. So then I started saying it like I meant it. I mean, that clip right there just points out just how hollow his campaign rhetoric was. And, you know, we have to confront Matt Gaetz on that. You know, he was completely unwavering in his support of Trump. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, Trump has kind of redefined what the term the swamp means. Now he says, oh, it's the deep state and it's the entrenched career politicians and it's the liberal media. It's like, no, the swamp is not the liberal media. It's the special interests and the lobbyists and the super PACs and the big donors, the corporations that you yourself, Mr. President, called out on 2016 campaign and was a huge part of your rise in the Republican primaries, just like it was a huge part of Bernie Sanders' rise in the primaries in 2016. So we obviously have to call balls and strikes on the president, but while at the same time, just trying to say, look, like both sides of the political spectrum agree on these issues. It's like you voted for Trump because he said he wanted to drain the swamp, and he was right about that. It's just the tragedy is he didn't do that. He never had any intention of doing that, and you should hold him to account for that at the ballot box.
And Andrea, anyone who's studied Greek tragedy knows that self-knowledge is the hardest type of knowledge to possess, and it is our lack of self-knowledge that is often our undoing. And in the case of Matt, what is so frustrating is because he doesn't see a inherent conflict between his support of Trump and his desire to eliminate the corrupting influence of money on the system. You know, there's this moment in the film where he says that you can be partisan bipartisan fluid,
right,
which is quite a construction. We have had long off the record conversations with him trying to grasp that dichotomy. And he just feels that, like, look, we can go and we can argue as bitterly as we want on some partisan issue, and then we can just turn around and we can work together on something like ending the wars, and that disconnect will not really endure. And maybe it doesn't for him, but it does for pretty much everybody else. And that you can also champion getting money out of politics and be such a sycophant to the, you know, the poster child for the corrupting influence of money in politics. I mean, you know, it makes your head spin. But as Dan says, you know, at least Gates ultimately walks the walk. And being in the, you know, just to be clear, if you're in the minority party in either House and Congress, you really can't do anything anyway. You know, Gates, they're like, oh, why doesn't Gates pass some legislation? Gates cannot, right? And there's no legislation that gets through the House without Nancy Pelosi's approval. But he can set an example, and to his great credit, he does set an example. And because he is such an influential figure in the Republican Party, perhaps that will give license to Republicans who would see that as heterodoxy to be willing to take that step now that somebody went into the pool first.
You know, I'm sure this is heavily influenced by a lot of reading I've been doing recently on Roger Ailes, the former, the CEO and kind of creator of Fox News. But my understanding is that he envisioned television and specifically Fox News as being a sort of replacing the modern political parties. And so in some ways, I kind of imagine that maybe, you know, Matt Gaetz's devotion to Trump is just sort of swapping out congressional leadership and party leadership for Trump, because Trump is the head of the TV party. You know, he is the king of TV. He understands that medium better than anyone. He used it to become president. And you know, that's my two cents of punditry on, and I guess maybe a little bit of psychology on Matt Gaetz and Trump. I don't want to leave the other two out. So I'll just point out, and you know, if you have anything to add to this, please do. But the other two congressmen you follow also have pretty remarkable kind of conflicts as well. Maybe not as stark as Matt Gaetz's, but one that really stands out is Congressman Massey from Kentucky. I had no idea. I'm sure most people didn't. This guy lives totally green. I mean, off the grid, totally green. You're talking about driving a Tesla, house entirely powered by solar. And yet, unlike Matt Gaetz, just doesn't believe in the threat of climate change, doesn't believe in the harm of increased carbon dioxide emissions. Can you draw a line between that view and the money he receives? Or how do we explain that?
It's really nearly impossible to explain, but we really try to do our best in the movie because, like, you know, by all accounts, he's like this brilliant, successful MIT inventor, but he doesn't believe in climate change. So the only, you know, we talked it through with him many times and really tried to understand. But, you know, the only conclusion we can really draw is that he is from Kentucky, one of the states with the biggest contingent of coal miners in the coal industry. And although that we challenge him on it and he says there's not an operating coal mine in his district, you know, we know how Kentucky, people in Kentucky feel about coal. So he lives off the grid. He has a solar powered house. He drives a Tesla, but the license plate of his Tesla says Friends of Coal.
Right.
So
yeah, one thing that's interesting that Larry Lessig says in our film is he describes this iceberg effect in contributions, which is actually really brilliant in the sense that it's not just that you take money from a certain industry and that you're beholden to that industry, but oftentimes your behavior and your positions can be dictated by the fear of your opponent getting money or money coming out at you, you know, because of your positions. And we detail how the Koch brothers essentially said to any Republicans that signed on to the truth about climate change that they would suffer at the ballot box. And so Thomas Massie would not acknowledge that correlation. But, you know, we've seen that the tremendous blowback against Republicans in this country when they have been willing to speak out about the horrors of climate change. And maybe Matt Gaetz is in a unique situation because every member of the Florida House delegation, Democrats and Republicans alike, acknowledge climate change. And maybe when you have, you know, algae blooms that completely make it impossible for you to use your beaches, or you just see so manifestly these terrible tropical storms that, you know, you can't keep your head in the sand about it. But certainly there is just tremendous pressure exerted by the big donors to the Republican Party and the fossil fuel industry to stay silent about climate change. And so, you know, we draw that conclusion that Massie wouldn't agree upon. But I think it's pretty manifest that whether it is specifically applicable to Thomas Massie, that there are positions that members of Congress hold because they're afraid that someone will come and challenge them, fueled by the moneyed interests, if they do go against that grain.
And then to his credit, he does demonstrate some courage again towards the end of the movie. You show how he bucks his party in supporting the War Powers Act, which would constrain the powers of the president to take sort of unilateral military action. So does Matt Gaetz. That's one of the votes that the last congressman we haven't talked much about, Ken Buck, he does vote against the War Powers Act, kind of just lining up with his party. And you note at the end of the film that indeed he is running for re-election, and as is Thomas Massie, but now Thomas Massie kind of fielded pretty much instantaneously a primary challenge pretty directly because of the vote that he took against the party and in support of the War Powers Act. The last kind of bit of questions I have for you, just to wrap up our conversation, is about impact. I'm curious, the film is now released. It's very newly released as we record this today, but I'm just curious, since its public release, any reactions, either kind of writ large, that you want to share, or maybe also any reactions from DC, from lawmakers?
Well, we've been really happy to see people's responses to it, and especially those who say, you know, really opened their eyes to how Congress really works and were happy to be challenged on their own biases and their own bubbles and their own preconceived notions of how the system works. That's very gratifying. Of course, we were aware there would be a lot of haters because we're completely challenging the orthodoxy. But our intention was with this film was to make a film that could appeal to all Americans, that, you know, so often political docs are just confirmation bias. And what we wanted to do was make a film for the American people. And of course, the leadership of the Democratic and Republican parties are probably not going to be too happy about what we have to say about how they are both corrupted by the money that is plaguing our government. But overall, we're happy to speak truth to power, and we're happy to speak directly to the American people and have this call for us to come together on this one issue, because really we could disagree about every other issue and we could fight those battles out in the future. But it really doesn't matter unless we first fix our broken Congress, because the Congress is completely paralyzed to do anything in the interest of the American people.
Andrew, your listeners know, because they are so familiar with this topic, that the Republicans and the Democrats are colluding when it comes to money and politics. And that's just the fact. And that doesn't mean that they are engaging necessarily in the same level of corruption. And probably depending upon your partisan orientation, you think that the other party is far worse than yours. But if you think about it like this, if one party is fully owned by the fossil fuel industry and the other party is only half owned by the fossil fuel industry, you don't get substantive climate change legislation passed. If you have one party that is wholly owned by Big Pharma and the insurance companies, and you have another party that's only half owned by it, you don't get Medicare for all. You don't even get a public option like we saw with the Affordable Care Act. And so this is paralyzing us on every single substantive and important policy goal that we have as a country. And it's fine when we're in a time of economic boom, when everything is going great, for us to be like, you know what, like, it's okay that Congress doesn't work. But at a time when we are so troubled as a nation, we are facing so many existential threats to the health and continued vitality of the republic, we can't afford to pay this corruption tax on every single issue anymore. We need to be able to have our legislators vote based upon what is right, not based upon the fear or the incentive of the influence of money in politics. And that's why, you know, we are very proud of this movie, because I think that's a message that a lot of people are afraid to get out, because, you know, there's so much concern over who wins the presidential election. And how can you say anything about that would undermine the Democrats and help Trump get elected? I mean, the thing is that it doesn't matter who the president is. The iron grip that the special interests have on Congress will perpetuate no matter who is the president, unless we change the system fundamentally. And the whole point of the reason that Congress is the Article I institution in the Constitution is because Congress is supposed to be the most powerful institution. It's the one that is supposed to allocate funds and to be the policy driver for the nation. And we need to liberate Congress from the grip of money. And so, you know, if we have to burst some people's bubbles to do so, like, we need to burst that bubble now, because we are in trouble.
Well, I'm going to leave it there and just say thank you both so much for taking the time to chat. And I really appreciate the level that, of depth we got into it. But I'll also warn all of our listeners that we did not give it all away for free. So please definitely check out the film on HBO. There's a lot more than we had time to cover today, and I think you'll really, really enjoy it. So the film is The Swamp. It's on HBO now. And Dan and Morgan, thank you so much for being so gracious with your time and sharing your insights. And thank you for doing this documentary.
Thank you so much, Andrew. This is a really great conversation.
Thanks, Andrew.
Stay up to date with the latest fundraising trends, forecasts, and advice by going to the CallTime AI blog at www.calltime.ai. And follow us on Twitter at CallTime AI.